If you thought red fire ants were bad, you know, the invasive biting ant colonizing the southern U.S., costing Texas alone an estimated $1.2 billion every year, if you thought that species was worrisome, allow me to introduce you to the crazy ant. And yes, that's its real name. Writing this week in the journal Biological Invasions, researchers report that the tawny crazy ant can out-invade even the red imported fire ant, taking over their nests and driving them out. In some areas where these tawny crazy ants have moved in, they can outnumber all the other ant species there combined by 100 to 1. Joining me now to talk about the crazy ant is Ed LeBrun. He's a research associate in the Brackenridge Field Station, part of the Department of Integrative Biology at UT Austin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Flora. Thank you for the invitation.
Why are they called crazy ants?
Crazy ants is the common name for the genus, and it stems from the way they move. All ants in this genus forage in a fairly erratic manner, or what appears to be erratic manner, and gives them an appearance that I guess people considered crazy.
They look like they're moving twice as fast as other ants around them.
Yeah, they have a very high tempo of movement. They move very rapidly. They have long legs. They explore the environment in a lot of ways.
And what makes them so good at invading?
Well, they share a suite of traits with a lot of the world's worst invasive ant species. One of which is that they're what's called supercolonial, and if on a continental scale, they can be called unicolonial. What that means is that colonies don't recognize boundaries. There's no within a population. There's no aggression between crazy ants. All individuals in the population treat other individuals in the population as members of the same colony. So you can take ants from any population in Texas, introduce them into another population in Texas, or I haven't tested this, but probably other parts of the Southeast, and they will join and work together. So that's really cuts down the costs of intraspecific competition and can allow the more efficient use of space in the environment they're in. They also rely very heavily on sugary resources that they get from homopteran insects, things like aphids and mealybugs, and they seem to be very good at exploiting these resources, which helps maintain their populations at very high densities.
I'm Flora Lichtman, and this is Science Friday from NPR. Talking about crazy ants for the rest of the hour. You know, I've been watching a lot of YouTube videos on crazy ants, and if you want to while away the afternoon, there's maybe no better way than...
There's some good ones out there.
There's some good ones. And they seem... There are many videos of crazy ants invading electrical boxes, almost to the point where it seems like there's some attraction. What is going on here?
Well, it's definitely a point where people come into contact with them a lot, because when your power goes out and you want to know why, and you find a bunch of ants, that's a good reason to get your video camera. their boxes, power boxes, are basically really good cavities. So these ants nest in pre-existing cavities. They don't. They do a small amount of digging, but they exploit whatever cavities they can find. So that's the reason that they move into electrical boxes and pump switches. But once they get electrocuted, when I've been collecting these ants in the past, you collect them into a vial, and they're all very agitated inside the vial. And when they're agitated, they release something called an alarm pheromone, which is a signal that they used. Chemical that they use to communicate with other ants that there's a threat. If you then take that vial and you set it down next to a trail of crazy ants, rather than fleeing from that plume of odor, they actually turn and head towards the vial. So they seem to be attracted to their alarm pheromones, their alarm pheromone. And so as a result, that kind of snowballs. So you get an ant that's electrocuted, it releases alarm pheromones, more ants pile on.
That seems odd that they would be attracted to the alarm.
It is a little odd, except for a lot of ants do this. It's part of how ants organize the defense of nests, for example. So if there's an intruder, you release alarm pheromones, and nest mates know that there's a threat that they need to be defending against.
Hmm. Do they bite?
They do, but it's almost imperceptible. They're pretty soft-bodied for ants, and unless they get you in a very sensitive spot, you can't even feel it. But And fire ants have a stinger, so they sting. So that's what the painful part of a fire ant sting is.
What's the future of these guys? Do you think that they're going to populate the whole south? I mean, is there any limit to their migration?
Well, there's several limits. We don't know what a lot of them are yet. One very important limit in the short term is that they don't have wing dispersal, so they don't send out winged ants to form new colonies, which means their spread is quite slow over land, about 200 meters a year radially. So the only way that they can colonize distant places is when people pick them up and move them, which unfortunately people do a lot. And they do it because these ants like to live in these pre-existing cavities like flower pots or plywood you left on the ground too long or old boxes. So that's one limitation to their spread. Others are abiotic limitations like freeze tolerance and drought tolerance, and we don't know yet what those are for this species. My impression from what I've seen is that they are more sensitive to these things than imported fire ants are, and so that they should have a less extensive distribution when all is said and done. But that's still something we've got to figure out.
Do you have recommendations for people who see them in the last 30 seconds we have?
Yeah, don't move them around. If you have them on your property or you're visiting a place that has them, take time and be careful about what you transport from there.
I think that sounds like good advice. Ed LeBron is a research associate at the Brackenridge Field Station, which is part of the Department of Integrative Biology at UT Austin. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Flora.
Our program senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Our associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Eli Chen is our assistant producer. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. If you missed any part of this program or you want to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts, audio and video on iTunes and Android apps, or listen on our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can also join our mailing list. Or, if you'd like to write us in the analog way, it's 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can email us at scifry@sciencefriday.com. In New York, I'm Flora Lichtman.